Members and audience, we're going to go with a few bills that are docket here, at least until 2:30, at which time we're going to have the Oasis Project presentation, so we'll try to keep to that schedule. And we have another committee coming in at 3:30, so we'll do that. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 592. Janet.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senate Bill 592 is at the request of the Credit Union Association, and it would grant to state chartered credit unions the authority to sell negotiable checks, such as traveler's checks, money orders, and other money transfers, including electronic transfers to persons that are eligible for credit union membership, whether or not they people are credit union members. It would also allow credit unions to, for a fee, cash checks and money orders, or send and receive electronic transfers for persons, again, whether or if they're eligible for credit union membership, whether or not they're members. And it would allow a person who's not a member of a credit union to be a guarantor or a co-obligor on a credit union's loan to a member of the credit union. These provisions, and there's also a replacement of a $500 fee with a fee to be established for opening of a branch of a credit union established by DCBS. And there's one, for credit unions whose membership is mostly low income, allows receipt of deposits from non-members and allows the person to hold shares in a credit union, again, a non-member. And it also allows such a credit union, again, with a low income membership to issue secondary capital accounts which are not federally insured. Those will be only subject to the terms and conditions established by DCBS. Most of these provisions are recently been allowed at the federal level for federally chartered credit unions, and they mirror some of those provisions in the change in the federal act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Pam Levitt, Scott Burgess, and Hal Scoggins, if you'd come forward, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Credit Union Association of Oregon, and here with me is Scott Burgess, President and CEO of Rivermark Community Credit Union, and Hal Scoggins, the retained counsel. In the interest of time, you have our material, and I'll let the experts talk about this bill, and Scott's going to go first.
Thank you, Scott.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Scott Burgess, and I'm the President and CEO of Rivermark Community Credit Union. Rivermark is headquartered in Beaverton, Oregon, and serves over 44,000 members in Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Marion, Yamhill, and Polk counties, and we currently stand at about $360 million in assets. I just want to briefly talk to you about the process by which Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions have identified the proposed amendments to the Oregon Credit Union Act as reflected in Senate Bill 592. Over the past year, I've had the privilege of serving as the chair of the Credit Union Association State Issues Subcommittee, and state chartered credit unions throughout the state of Oregon participate on this committee, and those that don't are solicited for feedback. And every 2 years when the legislature convenes, this committee, one of their primary purposes is to review the Oregon Credit Union Act and study the law to determine if there are any modifications that need to be made to ensure that state chartered credit unions can continue to best serve our members. And this is what we've really been working on substantially over the last several months. And throughout this process of reviewing the Credit Union Act, we solicited feedback from all state chartered credit unions and incorporated their feedback into these proposed changes. And Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions, I'm very pleased to say, have supported these recommended changes unanimously without exception. And it's been a very good process to work through, and I want this committee to be aware that all the proposed changes are being recommended solely based on Oregon Credit Union's mission of providing the best service possible to members across the state of Oregon. The financial marketplace changes every day, as do our members' needs, and we need to update our act to keep up with those changes. And in addition, Congress will pass new powers for federally chartered credit unions that would also be beneficial to Oregon credit unions and Oregon consumers. I'm going to just briefly touch on a few of the substantial changes we're recommending for the act. And then Hal Scoggins, our attorney, will talk about these in more detail. But basically, we talked about one of the issues was in regards to specific fees and whether they need to be included in the statute. And so we felt that it was probably appropriate to have those set by administrative rule and to be changed or modified by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We also looked at money services. Congress recently passed a law to allow credit unions to sell money transfer instruments such as cashier's checks, traveler's checks, or money orders. And we believe that state chartered credit unions should also have this authority, and it fits with our mission of people helping people. We also looked at the low income designation for credit unions, and for several years the federal charter has allowed for a low income designation credit union, and that law is designed to help a credit union designated as low income better serve the underserved in their area. The state act would allow for this designation. And we also wanted to clarify the process and member rights in connection with expulsion of members. And this is something that unfortunately occasionally has to occur. And this would occur, for instance, when a member threatens or harasses a credit union employee or another member of the credit union. So we felt that this was an appropriate time to better clarify and define that process. We also wanted to take this opportunity to better define and make it clear that a loan to a member is not prohibited simply by adding a non-member, for example, a spouse, as a co-borrower or guarantor. And throughout this process, we worked closely with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities to draft and review the bill. And it's been a very good process. All the credit unions, state charter credit unions in the state of Oregon are very excited to have this bill considered, and I would urge your support. So thank you again, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to testify today. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you, Mr. Burgess. I think we'll go to Mr. Scoggins, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Witt, and we're the outside counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. In respect of your time, I will briefly summarize the key provisions of this bill and then, of course, be happy to answer any questions. I lump this bill into really three categories of changes. The first is really technical, taking a couple of the fees, the only remaining fees in the Credit Union Act that were set by statute, and changing that to allow the Department of Consumer and Business Services to set those by rule. They like that. We like that. It's good for everybody. And so that was one thing that we did at their request and at our own urging as well. The second is really a group of technical changes that deal with the ins and outs of day-to-day credit union operations. As Scott alluded to, the one change in terms of member withdrawals and expulsions, the statute currently requires any member to give the credit union formal written notice before they withdraw. In reality, that never happens. People close their account, they go away. We'd like for them not to be breaking the law when they do that. So we've made that little update. And also, as Scott alluded to, with that change, we've proposed amending the process for expulsion. I know there's been some questions about expulsion. It does not happen often. The usual time that this happens is if somebody is harassing a credit union employee or threatening or abusive to them. Expulsion from membership is one of the things that the credit union can do to keep their employees and their other members safe. And so we've clarified that process a little. Then the third group of changes, which in my mind is really the centerpiece of the bill, is two major changes that are designed to help credit unions really fulfill their mission of serving their members, and especially members of modest means and members who may be underserved by other financial institutions. You will have written testimony from Mr. Martinez of the OBA, and it talks about further blurring the distinctions between banks and credit unions with these powers, which to me is a little ironic because for years their mantra has been credit unions must serve people of modest means and underserved, and that's what we're trying to expand here, and now they don't like that either. little bit odd. But the two real provisions that allow us to do this, one is a change that mirrors a change from federal law that occurred last year in the Financial Services Regulatory Relief Act, and that is where Congress empowered federal credit unions to do check cashing and money transmission services for people that are within your field of membership, even though they may not be members. Well, why would we want that? What is this all about? Well, what that really gets at is there's a group of people out there who are underserved. They either don't have enough money routinely to feel like they can maintain an account at a financial institution, or for some other reason they don't feel like they're comfortable maintaining an account at a financial institution. But they still need to have access to the ability to buy money orders, to send checks, in some cases maybe to send wire transfers to relatives or whomever. And so what this does is it allows credit unions to serve those people if they're within the credit union's field of membership, even though they don't actually maintain an account, which would be required for them technically to be a member. So this is a way for credit unions to be able to expand their service to this group of underserved people. Then the other similar provision is one that, as Scott said, has been around in federal law for a number of years, and that is the ability to have what's called a low-income designation. And this gives a couple of critical opportunities that we would like to take advantage of for state chartered credit unions under state law as well. And those two opportunities are to be able to accept deposits from non-members, and then also to be able to issue what are called secondary capital accounts. And these are accounts that would be they would be secondary in order of priority to all the other accounts of the credit union in terms of a liquidation payout. And because of that, they get to be treated as capital for regulatory purposes. Now, why would this be important in serving people of low and modest, low-income, modest means, underserved? Well, the reason is, if you think about that group of people, they generally have a lower average deposit balance than the rest of your members, the rest of people who make deposits in financial institutions. In order to loan money to members, we have to have money to lend. And this is another way to generate more money. If you are serving a group of members that's predominantly low income and has lower average deposits, this is a way of generating more cash to be able to lend to those members, which a credit union or a bank that's serving a different population wouldn't have that same difficulty. So that's something, as I said, that's been available under the Federal Credit Union Act for federal credit unions for years, and we want to make it available for state chartered credit unions on this side of the ledger as well. There are some amendments that we'll be offering. You don't have those in front of you yet, but I did want to mention them. As we've talked about some of these things with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, one of the things that they would like us to add in is for this check cashing authority would be to have the same limits on fees for the check cashing services that would be imposed on licensed check cashers under the pending House Bill 2202, I believe. And, you know, we have no problem doing that, so that will be a part of the amendments that we would submit. And then the way that the bill is drafted right now, as far as the low-income designation is concerned, it actually reads as if the department has to make a separate rulemaking for every credit union that it wants to designate as a low-income credit union. That obviously is not an efficient process and not the way that we want it to be. They can promulgate rules to govern how that process will work. But once the rules are out, then designating individual credit unions as low-income credit unions should not be a rulemaking process. So that is the sum and substance of the bill, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. So, Mr. Scoggins, I just want to, and I passed out to members, Mr. Martinez's testimony. Mr. Martinez told me last night he could not be here today. So he provided the written testimony, and so I want to reiterate a couple of points that Mr. Martinez made. What you have said, I believe, is that in the sections, and I think we'll hear from DCBS because my impression is this has some connection with DCBS's desires. The money cashing, the electronic transfers, things for non-members, you say, is allowed for federal chartered credit union.
That is correct. Okay. That is part of federal law for federal credit unions right now.
Okay. Because, and then you also, on the deposits that you just finished discussing with the low-income credit unions, so the department would determine by rule what qualifies, what type of credit union would qualify for low-income, and that also is currently available in federally chartered credit unions?
That's correct.
Okay, and then the final one, and I am curious about this, why do we have an emergency clause on the bill? Mr. Martinez was questioning that as well.
The only thing that I can say, well, there's two things I can say. One is that every time legislative counsel is asked, do we want an emergency clause, and I say no, I have regretted it. The second and better answer is that there's no reason that Oregonians should have to wait to have access to more services from credit unions that are generally cheaper and better than those that might be available from the alternatives. And simply in order for credit unions to be able to provide services to this group of underserved people of modest means, now instead of, well, when the bill becomes effective rather than waiting until January 1st.
Mr. Chair, Pam Levitt, I would have no problem taking that out if that's an issue with the chair at all.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's only one real thing, only one small minor thing, at least it should be hopefully minor, that I have a problem with this bill, otherwise it looks fine to me, which is a growing concern that I have over us taking fees set in statute and moving them to rule. I just can't go there. The legislature already has an immense, we already grant huge rule writing authority to agencies, and then the only thing that we actually have left sort of our somewhat piece of control over agencies is the amount of fees that we allow them to charge. And one of my big, I'm going to sound like a broken record every single time, but I'd rather have fees set in statute every single time rather than granting that rule. So I can't support a bill, just so you know, I just can't support a bill that takes a fee that is written in statute and then turns around and makes that by rule. I just think it's the wrong trend for where we're going. I just wondered if there was...
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I would say, and Hal, correct me if I'm wrong, is that we found in our process that we were going through that most of our rules were set in statute, and we found that this was interesting because it was, you know, in laid out there. So we were kind of going with the trend in ORF 723.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that is correct, and we have in the past, in other bills, actually taken some of the other fees out already, and I understand and appreciate your concern, and I think many credit unions would understand and appreciate the concern as well. And it's kind of a two-edged sword that we faced. In some cases, actually, there was the hope, potentially, that fees might even be able to go down as opposed to up, and it's just allowing greater flexibility. But,
Mr. Chair, it just kind of a follow-up to that. It's just, at some point, I don't know exactly why we show up down here. We give all of our rule writing authority to agencies, and we give them all the fund writing authorities. At some point, you know, at some point there's a philosophical point that I kind of cross. And I guess after seeing so many bills come through that say this, I'm sort of starting to draw more of a hard line every time I see these things, just so you know. And if it would be a friendly amendment, I'd actually prefer it stay in statute. And if you want to lower it, I would be more than happy to vote for that, too. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, since we do have a package of amendments, I'll follow up with you, and we'll try to work that issue
out.
Thank
you very much.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just bear with me for a moment. I think I'll direct these towards the attorney because I think they're more just in the definition of low income. So my understanding is you get Rivermark, for example, is through DCBS is determined to be a low income credit union, for example, and I'm not sure if that's the case or not. Then I walk in and I'm in the field of membership but not a member of Rivermark, and I want to cash a check. How would you go about determining if I'm there, that I am both in the field of membership and low income, or am I off base, and how this would practically work out?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Deckert, the two provisions, the check cashing provision and the low income designation, are actually completely separated from each other. And the check cashing provision simply says, irrespective of whether you're designated as a low income credit union or not, you can provide these services to somebody who is within the field of membership but who is not a member. It doesn't say that you have to. And for instance, having somewhat of an idea that you might not be a person of modest means walking in the door of Rivermark, they might say, well, you know, we really want to provide these services for members or for certain others. I don't know that they would do that or not do that. But that is separate from the low-income designation. And the way that the low-income designation would work is once the application process has been gone through and DCBS has determined that the credit union is, in fact, a low-income credit union, then it has the authority to offer those accounts and the secondary capital accounts, and it's not restricted who those accounts are offered to, and you're not required to be a person, a specific low-income person, in order to be eligible to make those deposits. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Can I throw one other, and then, Pam, you might be able to knock these both out. So, and then how fill the membership, just to get right back at it. How do I tell you that I'm within Rivermark's field of membership?
Want to go through the process?
Well, for Rivermark, if you live or work in a particular geographic location, in our case it's a 6-county area, then we get the proper identification, determine that you live, or we get a pay stub and determine that you work in one of the 6 counties and you're eligible to join.
Okay, so that's okay.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I might add one thing to that, because membership is, of course, one of the distinguishing features of credit unions. And we have had clients where occasionally people have misrepresented their circumstances in order to become eligible for membership, and then when the clients have found out that they really didn't qualify, they have, in fact, disaffiliated those people from membership. So it is something that the credit unions take seriously.
Senator Marsans.
Thank you. I want to follow up on that then. It sounds like then you want to be able to, and I'm looking at page 3, lines 42 and 43, that you want to expand the monies that come into your organization, and it wouldn't meet, like, what Mr. Burgess said regarding living in the city or in the area. Is that why you are adding wanting to receive deposits from a person that is not a member of the credit union? Because actually, if your rules were set up that you had to live in the district or be a part of an organization, that you could not become a member. Is this why you're doing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monison Anderson, yes, the basic idea is that if a credit union is primarily serving low-income people, it may need access to additional core deposits in order to perform its lending function effectively to that community. And those deposits might come from a number of sources. They might come from nonprofit organizations that wouldn't otherwise qualify to make deposits. That's one thing that happens occasionally. Or they might just come from individuals who have a desire to serve the community in that way. Or they might come from some other source. They might just come from somebody who wants a good return on their money. But from the credit union's perspective, if that helps them to fulfill their mission of providing lending services to that group, then so much the better.
I'm gonna cut that off because I've got to go. We're out of time. Is there any other burning questions for this group? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Tatlin, you want to come forward for DCBS?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is David Tatman, and I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and that's a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The department has been charged by the legislature with the oversight and regulation of credit unions chartered by the state of Oregon. And so I'm here today to present testimony. You should be receiving written testimony about our view on the proposed bill, Senate Bill 592, that you just heard testimony on. In light of the short time and the urgency of other business in front of the committee, I would like to just touch on a couple of things. My written testimony should address most of the issues. I just wanted to say there are a couple of areas where, as a regulator, this bill would change our regulatory authority, and we wanted to weigh in on that. Senator George brought up the issue about provisions regarding fees. There are three fees that are already set by rule. There are two fees that are currently set by statute. Those two fees are the initial application fee of $150 and a application fee for a branch office of a credit union at $500. We think that that's out of balance. The fee should be not necessarily numerically reversed, but the new application certainly takes considerably more time than a branch review. So the situation was, how can we change those things to reflect the amount of time that's necessary to address a review of those applications? The other issue that came up were a couple other general powers. One, the director had authority to restrict contributions made by credit unions. That authority was given to us over 25 years ago. In the over 25 years, we have never seen fit to do any rulemaking in that area. It doesn't make sense to retain that authority on the books when it's not being exercised. We don't think that's a problem area. So in the efforts, if you will, towards regulatory streamlining, we support that concept. The other concept briefly I want to touch on was the notion of having a non-member guarantee or serve as a co-obligor on a loan. And I think it was Mr. Burgess referenced that sometimes someone will be a member but the spouse won't be, and for obvious reasons they both have to be on the loan. Or better yet, as I've had this personal experience myself, you may have a young adult child who is obtaining a loan to purchase a car, and the credit union won't necessarily accept that loan, but they want a co-obligor or guarantor on that. And in that situation, it makes sense not to deprive somebody of the opportunity to obtain that loan because someone's not a member that's going to co-sign. The last two points, or the two key issues that Mr. Scoggins brought up, I just want to point out what the chair has already raised, and that is there is an issue of federal parity. The statute already allows for the department to look at practices that are being authorized under the National Credit Union Association, the NCUA, for federal chartered credit unions. As we've mentioned, there are 21 credit unions in the state of Oregon chartered by the state, and there are 64 credit unions chartered by the NCUA here in Oregon. There's a concern that anytime there are certain federal powers that have been granted to federal credit unions, that the state may see that as advantageous and they would like to be in equal standing or in parity. We can do that on a case-by-case basis to match up the parity issue, but as Mr. Scoggins pointed out, rather than do that, it makes a lot more sense to try and address that in a general status. And so both in terms of authorization to issue traveler's checks or money orders or cash checks for non-members, and to grant low-income status, it makes sense to do that in a broad blanket format rather than on a case-by-case basis. The only thing I will close with is that, as Mr. Scoggins pointed out, we want to make sure that charges, fees that could be charged to non-members for check cashing purposes would be at or below the same level that we're going to see for check cashing practices. In fact, that bill was heard yesterday in front of Senator Prozanski's committee, and we understand that Mr. Scoggins will be coming forward with amendments to reflect similar fees or lower than those fees. And so with that, we would, if this body chooses to go forward with that concept, we would encourage it to do so with such limitations in place.
Thank you, Mr. Chapman. We will do that. Just one question for you. I know the department has been working with the association on different desires that the department has had in terms of providing services. Do any of these reflect that discussion? I mean, you talk about whether you support or oppose some of the elements. I want to know if you're party to any of the elements. I mean, have you been working with the credit union on providing any of these services, or is this separate and distinct from any of your desires for the services they are providing?
Mr. Chair, in fact, we did meet with them, and they do reflect some of our general concerns. This works to address concerns that the department and the governor has regarding people that are, we're calling underserved or are not banked, that need the opportunity for exposure and opportunity to use certain services like this. The fact is that in this day and age, we have something called community chartered credit unions, and anybody can be a member. The membership restrictions have been lowered, and so we're seeing those opportunities expand, and we think this follows on its heels. We're particularly encouraged by the concept of the low-income designation because we know that the National Credit Union Association will provide certain services, technical assistance, such as working with computers and bringing them up to date and making sure they're in compliance with the new requirements in using computers. And secondly, they will provide working loans, if you will, low-cost loans for these designations, credit unions that are designated as low-income credit unions. Both those, we think, ultimately serve the membership if the majority of them are low-income. So, yes, it does reflect things that we think are important to serving Oregonians in general.
Questions for Mr. Catman? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll await those amendments. And well, I don't know if the committee will adopt it or not, but Ms. Leavitt, will you work with Senator George on what that fee might look like? And if you come to an understanding on that, propose that as a separate amendment from the others so we can look at that. And for that for the purposes now, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 592. I don't know that we're going to get to Senate Bill 1022 and 2268 since we're past the time. And I have people here that I don't want to let you sit through, but I have promised this the start time for our presentation, and I don't want to change that. Only thing I would say, if the presentation and the questions from the committee gets us done before the end of the committee, I will go to those bills. But I want to keep my promise, we've got the folks here. So just be on notice on that. And sometimes we can't get to everything we want to do. So I want to open up the informational meeting on the Oregon Oasis Project. And I've got my list. Senator Nelson, Representative Schaffler, and Representative Jensen was on the list, but... All right, we'll take the two of you. All right. Kick us off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you having this meeting. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator. I live in Pendleton. I represent four counties out of Northeast Oregon. And this is an informational hearing on the use of water out of the Columbia River. And I'd just like to make five quick points. In our part of the country, we have some very rich farmlands where we need water. We have critical groundwater levels existing now, so we need water. We could develop a huge food processing industry in that particular area, which would help the entire state with jobs and taxes. Our farmers look across the river at the Washington State farmers, and they see that they're developing land on a continual basis, wondering why we can't do that in Oregon. And the fifth point is there's a huge volume of water in the Columbia River, and Oregon uses very little of that. My thought is one of the keys to Oregon's future is some wise use of the Columbia River water. And with that, I turn it over to Representative.
Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair, committee members, most able committee administrator. It's always good to see you. I'm Mike Schaffler. I'm state representative from Happy Valley. It's Happy Valley, outer southeast Portland, District 48. And I'm not a farmer like my friend here, but I grew up working on farms. My parents grew up on farms, and my cousins are still very farmers in Minnesota. So I have a soft spot in my heart for farmers already. But that all being said, when you look around the region and what people are doing to take advantage of the abundant resources that this state could take advantage of, and we're not, and it's a shame and it's criminal. We sit here and we scratch and we scrimp and we look for money for education, health care, and safety in this state while we're sitting on a gold mine. This is just one area of our gold mine that we have that we're not taking full advantage of. And I don't know if you all got this informational packet. I imagine you did. But when you compare us to Washington and Idaho, it's just flat out wrong that we're not irrigating tens of thousands more acres out in eastern Oregon. And there'll probably maybe some talk about science and stuff like that. You know, the only science I really need is you got some arable, fertile soil, and you got sunlight. You take that, you take a seed, you put it in that ground, and you pour water on it, something grows. That's as scientific as I need to get on this. And we need the feedstocks for this biofuels. It's going to be positive for the environment, and we need to create the thousands of jobs that this idea can. And if we don't, and the very same folks, real nice folks with good intentions and good hearts, they may come up here and disagree with this, tend to be the very same folks that come to ask me for more money and you for more money for education, health care, and safety. And I have to look them in the eye and say, I got it. We need to go get it. And as it just says here, Oregon refuses to budge. If we refuse to budge, then we'll be just stuck right in the same place we are. And when they ask for increase in budgets, the staff will say no. They want more money. We know where to get it. We have it. All we have to do is go and get it. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll just pass it along to my good friend from Pendleton.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Bob Jensen from Pendleton, and I'm here in support of this bill and would like to take just a moment of your time, if I may, to talk about it. There will be, I'm sure, some people with far more detail than I wish to get into. Later in the hearing your testimony, but I would like to specifically point out that the benefits of this proposal to Eastern Oregon are probably most easily seen in if you look at the people and the groups that are supporting it. You know, almost literally everyone from Eastern Oregon, from Boardman, you know, to Pendleton and East, the city of Hermiston, the city of Boardman, the city of Oregon, the city of Echo, and you have the list of the, you know, the supporters there. And there's, you know, a very good reason for this. I know when I first moved to Pendleton in 1967, coming across eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, at that time it was pretty barren, pretty desert sort of country. And, you know, there really wasn't a lot of difference between Pendleton and the Tri-Cities. There were the three towns there, Pasco, Kennewick, and Richland. In the recent years, because of the Columbia River and because of the very fertile land that we have and the climate that we have there, and the decisions that, for whatever the dynamics and reasons now, are somewhat unimportant. If we look and compare what has transpired on the north bank of the Columbia versus what has transpired on the south bank of the Columbia, Pasco was the same size as Pendleton at that time. Kennewick was smaller than Pendleton. And if you ever make that drive through there now, the Tri-City area, the Pasco, Kennewick, Richland area, is a thriving metropolis. Literally, going into Kennewick for miles is, you know, very well-developed communities. And there's really basically one reason for that. That's economics. They have utilized the resources that they had available to them and done so in a manner that has led to great economic growth and prosperity in those communities, while communities on the south side of the river have somewhat struggled. Part of the struggle that we were having was the difficulty of getting water. We were leaders on the south side of the river in good management, led the world in the technology of good management in irrigation. People from all over the world came to the area to see and observe what our farmers were doing. But we were limited because we couldn't get any more water. This bill is a measure to address that particular issue, and that's the reason that all of these communities, I think, are so enthusiastically behind it. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for taking time out to listen to me. I appreciate your hearing this measure and taking the time out of your schedule to hear it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you all. And just for the committee, I really want to thank Senate President Courtney, who allowing us to have this hearing today. And I know, Representative Schaffler, you're working on the issue over in the House. And while we don't have the specific Senate Bill 483 in this committee, and Senator Courtney was still happy to have us to hear the bill, and of course, there's other opportunities. But one thing I wanted to do is the committee to have the opportunity at least to hear what we were talking about, because it could still end up here. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Okay, now we have a group of panelists, but first I'm going to ask Ralph Groner, who has 1 minute. And the clock is ticking, and then...
he's going by Ralph the Groner.
Right.
Oh, my God. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I have a conflict. That's why I asked for the 1 minute. Ralph Groner with AskMe, and I'm also speaking for Bob Shiprock, the building trades. He had a doctor's appointment. My quote will not, hopefully won't take a minute. I've been working my Duffy off on a big issue for about 2 years called the Oregon Clean Air Initiative, most of which is coming in front of Senator Avakian's committee, and biofuels and biodiesel, et cetera. It would be Bob Shiprock's interest is jobs, jobs, jobs. Of course, that would interest labor, but I felt that it would be incongruous of my group and my organization to support biofuels because we care very much about the clean air and the healthier air and the $1 billion we can save with the multitude of programs we're sponsoring this session with DEQ to not support the water to grow those crops. And we happen to know for a fact that there are water shortages in that area, and we certainly aren't going to raise it here in the Willamette Valley. And if we're going to have biofuels that the governor and everybody says they want, then it seems to me common sense tells us that we need the water available to grow the crops to help keep me in Portland and Little Oregon City, where I live, with clean air. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Groner. Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. DiLorenzo, your first panel, if you'd like to come forward. And I hope, John, I really appreciate all this. I hope you don't intend to read it all because it will never get to even the second person on your panel.
But, I do not, Mr. Chairman.
But we always appreciate the organization of material that you provide us.
Kim, why don't you come on up, too? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine and am representing my client, Umatilla Electric Cooperative. We have been retained to work on the legal aspects of the Oregon Oasis Plan, and together with Mr. Rick Lick, in charge of our environmental department, and Mr. Greg Chamoff, have provided the legal work necessary to further the plan. I'd like to do three things. First of all, familiarize you with the resource book that you have. Not summarize it, just tell you where things are, because a number of our witnesses may be referencing items in it. Also, I'd like to address who our presenters are and what topic areas they intend to cover. And then I would like to take just a couple of minutes to review the key components of the Oregon Oasis Plan before the others take over. There's a table of contents in your resource book, and then by number one is a list of presenters. As you know, Senator Nelson, Representative Schaffler, and Representative Jensen already spoke. They are among our key supporters. We will be having after me Steve Elridge, who is the General Manager and CEO of the Umatilla Electric Cooperative, address the economic impacts of the plan. Mr. Kim Pusey, who is sitting by me, is the manager of the Port of Umatilla. He will be talking about the interrelationship between the Oregon Oasis Plan and the Biofuels Initiative and Clean Air. Following our panel will be a panel that it consists in part of Fred Ziari. Fred is the president of IRZ Consulting. He will address the relationship between the plan, helping the hungry, preservation of farmland, mitigation, and best management practices. Following him will be Dr. Jim Anderson. Dr. Anderson is a research professor from the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington. Dr. Anderson has developed a model which is utilized by NOAA Fisheries and has developed other models. He has reviewed the Oregon Oasis Plan in detail. He is prepared to provide his expert opinion that the Oregon Oasis Plan and the withdrawals required thereby will be of no harm to fish, and will lay out his reasons why. Finally, you've heard from Ralph Groner and Bob Shiprack. We will eliminate that panel because you've already heard that Mr. Shiprack cannot attend, but I would like you to know that there is significant labor support for this plan. At tab 2, you have an aerial photograph of the river showing the new acres, irrigated acres, that have been added in Washington as a result of Washington's withdrawal while we have sat on our hands. At number 3 are the handouts that we have been utilizing with respect to the plan. At tab 4 is a continuing outline, which discusses in detail the arguments for and against and our rejoinders to the arguments we have heard against so far. This is a work in process, and we will continue to update our outline as we hear new arguments and have new rejoinders. Tab 5 is a copy of Senate Bill 483, which is the bill in Senator Vakian's committee, which embraces the Oregon Oasis Plan. Tab 6 is the mirror bill in the House, House Bill 3525. It is a teamwork bill which has been filed under the House rule, which means it is guaranteed both a hearing and a work session. Tab 7 and 8 are the economic analyses which have been prepared by our economics advisor. Tab 9 is as an example of best management practices, which Mr. Ziari will likely refer to. And tab 10 through 13 are materials which Dr. Anderson will have occasion to refer to. I'd like to now just cover the key components of the Oregon Oasis Plan. For that purpose, I'd like to ask that you refer to tab 5. We'll go off Senate Bill 483. As you know, though, House Bill 3525 is identical. And if you would be so kind as to turn to this second page of the bill, after Section 1, which are definitions, the first operative section is Section 2. And Section 2 requires the Water Resources Department to issue permits to appropriate water from the Upper Columbia River for use in the Columbia Basin to any person who will use the water for a number of purposes. The Columbia Basin in Section 1 is defined as those counties in the state of Oregon that are pertinent to the Upper Columbia River or in which are located tributaries of the river. So anyone within that area would be able to utilize the benefits of this bill. The purposes are as follows. First of all, Umatilla County has a critical groundwater area, and so in lieu of using groundwater from critical groundwater areas that a person would otherwise be legally able to use river water under this plan. Secondly, to recharge or replenish groundwater in the critical groundwater area. Third, to support business development projects. And fourth, to provide additional water for municipal corporations, in other words, municipal use. Business development projects are defined in Section 1. There's a reference to a statute, but the relevant purposes would be manufacturing or other industrial production, agricultural development or food processing, development or improved utilization of natural resources, or other activities that represent new technologies or new economic enterprises that the OECDC has determined is needed to diversify the economy. In Section 2.2, A person who qualifies is a person who has the means to deliver water either through ownership of a water delivery system or through contract. In other words, private resources are used to deliver the water. This bill will cost the state nothing. It requires no state investment of dollars. All private resources would be utilized. That person must be certified by the Water Resources Department as capable of employing best management practices. They must, in fact, employ best management practices. And there is another section that provides that to the extent that they utilize groundwater in or river water in lieu of groundwater, that a subsequent curtailment order does not impair their use of the river water. That's something that Mr. Eldridge will talk about, a recent case that involves a total water shutoff by Water Resources Department. At the next page, page 3, there is 500,000 acre-feet in total that can be used, need not be used, but can be used. The priorities are 195,000 acre-feet for use of water in lieu of critical groundwater, 300,000 acre-feet for business development projects, and 5,000 acre-feet for municipal use. In section 3, there is a charge of $10 per acre foot for all water used for business development purposes. That fee, potentially up to $3 million per year, goes into a mitigation fund administered by the Water Resources Department in consultation with the Native American tribes for developing in-stream water conservation projects. And that's provided in Section 4. Finally, in Section 7, there is a provision which has come under some criticism by a number of organizations, but for which criticism is really not necessary because it only states what the law is, and it is merely a reminder to agencies that any rules which do not comply with the requirements and directives of the bill must yield to the bill. That's merely a reminder. We didn't even need to put that provision in because that's what the law would provide. Otherwise, in cases of any legislation that's passed, administrative rules must always yield to legislation. It's been a hurried review, but with that, I'd like to turn my time over to Mr. Eldridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for giving us the opportunity to talk about this. I'd like to start with just a little bit of the lay of the land. The Oregon Oasis Project will not bring parity with its neighboring states of Idaho and Washington. Washington uses 3 times as much water from the Columbia as does Oregon, and Idaho uses 7 times more. So this increases our amount by 14/100%. That's going to close the gap a little, but not much. Each year, about 198 million acre-feet of water go down to the Columbia, to the ocean. We, the Northwest states, take about 6.93% of that total flow. If Oregon Oasis is enacted, it'll be 7.017%. So our percentage of the total withdrawal will go from 7.5% to about 10%. Idaho's is 50%, and Washington's is a third, much more than Oregon. But this little bit of additional water, this 0.014% of additional water, will bring truly astounding economic benefit to Northeast Oregon. It'll provide water for 100,000 new acres of irrigated land. And with that irrigated land, we can grow high-value crops, fruits, and vegetables. And these crops, when processed in Oregon, create 5,500 to 7,300 jobs. And will provide $220 million annually in gross revenues, $25 million in new tax income for property taxes. I currently serve as chair on the Oregon Rural Policy Advisory Committee for the governor. And one of the things that we have discovered in economic development is strengthen the assets of each region is the most efficient and less expensive way to bring about new economic development. This does that. We are very well positioned. We know how to grow crops. We do it as efficiently, more efficiently than most. In fact, our irrigators have saved as much water as this would authorize additional water. we've been a leader in this regard for a number of years. Now, it's important to remember that Portland and Salem receive about 39 inches of rain a year. We receive 9 inches of rain. If we don't irrigate, then low-value crops is really the only opportunity we have to grow with the rainfall we have. It's also important to remember that 125-acre circle irrigation field will produce as much crop value as 5,750 acres of dryland wheat, dryland crops. So irrigated agriculture will produce 46 times more than what dryland will. It's a good, efficient use of resources. So in the field, in the case of field corn, or number two yellow corn, which is used in ethanol production, you can generate about 40 bushels an acre on ground without water. That results in $188 per acre every other year because of crop rotation. On the other hand, with water, this same corn crop can generate $1,000 per acre because of productivity. Onions can generate $4,000 per acre. Pears and sweet corn, $1,300 an acre. And potatoes up to $3,000 per acre. Truly exceptional economic value. Now, the other portion of Oregon Oasis is providing water for 65,000 acres of critical groundwater area. In our area, we have 4 of the 5 critical groundwater areas in the state of Oregon. Now, this just isn't a couple of large farms. We serve that area. These are all the customers that we serve. There's 3,060 members, over 5,000 electrical accounts. The farms include a 100-year-old farm, Madison Ranch, Eagle Ranch, Golden Canyon. In fact, Golden Canyon called me today to let us know that until today, they had enough water to irrigate 11,000 acres, and they were reduced to 696 acres. So the grass crop that they had put in at a cost of $500,000 was plowed under, dryland wheat was put in, 3 employees were laid off. And the annual benefit that we were receiving at $2.5 million is not there now. So this really is in crisis. People are being shut off as we speak. I can list them all if you'd like, but also remember the cities of Echo, Stanfield, Hermiston, all reside in these critical groundwater areas. Just 3 years ago, Umatilla County gave serious thought to a moratorium on domestic wells. And there was a great public outcry. But that would really put our communities on its ear if that occurred. So if we can put water on these critical groundwater areas and restore them to full productivity and grow these high-value crops, we generate $143 million a year in gross revenue to the state and local economies. So in total, the Oregon Oasis Project in the next 25 years has the potential of $363 million in gross local and state revenues annually from 100,000 acres of new irrigated land and restoring the 65,000 acres of farmland in critical groundwater. Attached to this report are briefing papers prepared by the Pacific Northwest Project, which did the economic studies for us, ran them through the university. We think our numbers are very conservative with the information provided. And the paper is titled The Regional Economic Significance of Columbia River Water Rights from the McNary and John Day Pools. Thank you for this very wonderful opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity. I'm Kim Pusey, General Manager of the Port of Umatilla, and I gave Adam a packet of information, including my written testimony. Before I get into that, I'd like to mention that Steve spoke about the farm today that lost their water. That farmer's name is Lloyd Piercy, and most of the people who will testify today know Lloyd. He's a real person. With a family who happened to have purchased a farm, and the water under the farm is no longer available to him, and so it's in his behalf as well as others that we come to you as well. In my biography, I mentioned that in the 1980s I was involved in the biofuels industry in the state of New Mexico, and authored a study by the New Mexico ethanol producers called Ethanol as a Targeted Industry for Economic Development. So I'd be happy to answer questions about biofuels when we get to that. I just have 3 points that I'd like to make, and each of those are accompanied by an editorial piece that I think the assistant gave to each of you. The first is that there are water infrastructure projects planned or currently being constructed throughout the world, in Turkey, Brazil, Paraguay, the People's Republic of China, eastern New Mexico, southern Utah, and central Washington. And we're not here to get money for infrastructure projects, but our neighbors throughout the world and in the region are doing something with respect to infrastructure and all of that requiring water. We're just here to ask for some enabling legislation to ask for a little bit of water, as has been mentioned. The second is that, and there's an editorial piece that speaks to this, I'm a beneficiary of generations of irrigated agriculture. I grew up in the arid rural American West and have always lived on, quote, the dry side of the state. And so irrigation is a big deal to me. Myself and my family have benefited because of irrigated agriculture. I managed an irrigated farm in northern New Mexico immediately out of graduate school. That led me into the biofuels industry, where I spent a number of years and so forth. But as a beneficiary of irrigated agriculture, I have some sense of the bounty and blessings that come from that, and feel an obligation to do what I can to be able to allow the available water and necessary infrastructure to come to the rising generation so that they'll have similar opportunities that we do. There's a direct correlation between environmental stewardship and poverty, and with the prosperity that could come to our side of the state, we would be able to do better things for the environment as well. The third thing that I would like to mention directly has to do with the biofuels industry, and that is that there are two models that are out there, and you and your co-legislators have been approached with a barrage of interests in biofuels. The governor has supported biofuels for the state of Oregon and so forth. We have an opportunity to either grow that industry locally with locally grown feedstock, either corn or canola oil, other cereal crops that would be used in ethanol production, cellulosic material for ethanol production, or we will be faced with having to import those feedstocks, either from the Midwest, if we're talking about cereal grains, primarily number two yellow corn, or crude vegetable oil from Malaysia and Indonesia. In order to have this be a local industry with local feedstocks that benefit local growers and sustain the local economy, we need to have the water available to irrigate those crops, as has been mentioned by Senator Nelson and others here on the panel. And I hope that you can see your way to allowing us to have the enabling legislation to withdraw some water from the Columbia River to grow the crops that will support the biofuels industry, as well as the other necessary food and fiber that come from our local producers. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you have about
that.
Thank
you. I think what we'll do is we can get as much information out in the time that we have. I'm going to ask the next panelist up. If anybody has questions, you stay in the room. And if we have time for that after we've heard everybody's presentation, we will ask you those questions at that time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
sir.
So I believe we have Mr. Zawari and Mr. Anderson, I believe, are next.
Good afternoon. I'm Fred Zawari. I'm president of IRZ Consulting, which is a Hermiston-based water resource management company. And for the last quarter of a century, we have been involved in advancing technology to conserve and increase the efficient management of water resources and irrigation, especially in Oregon, but throughout the world. It was interesting. I moved to Hermiston about 25 years ago, and I was born and raised by the Caspian Sea in Iran. And when I met the first farmer I met in Eastern Oregon, he started bragging that he's a fourth generation farmer. And my family was farming on the same farm for about 1,000 years. So I wasn't counting about generation.
That's correct.
We, our clients span the globe and include some of the largest, most efficient and productive agribusinesses in Oregon and Washington. In addition, I'm the chairman of the Eastern Oregon Irrigation Association, which is mainly in Eastern Oregon. Today, I'm here to testify in support of the Senate Bill 483 and House Bill 3525. Now, the question is, why do we need more water from Columbia River, and why now? For about 25 years, I have spoken about the urgency of this subject, and it is urgent. First, right here at home, for most of the past decade, Oregon has led the nation in hunger and food insecurity. As an Oregonian and as a member of Oregon's agribusiness community, that deeply disturbed me. Second, nationally, each year we take nearly 2 million acres of most productive America's farmland out of production.
Mr. Zari, I hate to interrupt you. I'm just trying to be respectful of your group.
Yes.
And I can see it's not going to happen unless I do some intervention here. We have your written testimony. And so, I think most of us have read through that, the background on the hunger, which is very important. So I'd like to have you skip ahead with your expertise now to tell us why this project, as we see in the latter part of your testimony, is critical to meeting that need, just so that we can have Mr. Anderson and we can make sure that, we don't have to stop and not hear some folks.
Okay, thank you. It's fair enough. But the bottom line is, we have 25,000 people a day die of starvation globally. We have the highest hunger rate in the nation was led by the state of Oregon. We can't just stand still and see every year we are adding about 100 million to the world's population. And my question for last quarter of a century was, who is going to feed the hungry and who is going to feed the world? It's not going to happen in Europe. Asia cannot feed itself. India is struggling. China is struggling to feed itself. The only countries in the world that are able to produce high value, high nutritious surplus food is Canada, Australia, and mainly United States and few countries in the South America. And that's the fact. We believe, and I believe, that really the reason that we need to develop in the irrigation out of the Columbia Basin, which is the most productive land, is Oregon and Washington. The rest of we lead the nation in highest yield per acre. And that is really important, because if you allow this happen other places, you got to cut down the forest in South America in order to put it in the farmland. And the yields are very, very low. So that's the reason I support this, because it is urgent. Our population is adding 100 million globally per year, and our hunger rate is increasing, and we need to do something about it. And the bill is provide for mitigation, which it never happened in the history of Oregon. So for every acre feet of water that we take, we are putting $10 per acre feet. So for the amount of water, about $3 million a year, you can capitalize that, some $45 million, $50 million. We can go buy mitigation for in-stream use, out-of-stream use, conservation, to make up the amount of water that is taken out, the very little amount of water. So you mitigate that amount. I just finished doing the Same thing for the state of Washington, where we identified close to 800,000 acres of conservation of water throughout the state. Let's spend this money that we take out of here to put it into conservation. The best management practices that I have mentioned in my testimony, we can increase through the use of technology, we can tremendously increase the efficiency. We already are, and I work all over the world. Eastern Oregon and Eastern Washington, the most advanced technology in the world, right there. And we continue to lead the world, and we need to do more of it, and we can do it. It's not, for me, it's not an either-or choices. We can't say we either got to put agriculture and hunger versus environment and other choices, because I believe the other choices, when a father or mother, their kids are going hungry, they will lose. But we can do this in environmentally sound without very little impact. And that's the summary of my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Zawori. Actually, first met Fred a number of years ago when we were being entertained by the co-op, I think, out in Hermiston. Had a chance to visit with you then, so I appreciate you coming all the way out for today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have to go to another committee. Can I ask one question to this panel? So one of the questions I've had is why scarce summer water versus more plentiful winter water? And my understanding is that this proposal would take water out during those scarce times in the summer.
It could be either or. Some of them could be taken during winter for maybe recharge of the groundwater, probably going to happen during non-irrigation season. But the one that is we are taking, because that's 80% of the water is used really in July and August. So you have to take it about when the crop needs it, the hottest part of the season. So you do it that way. And that's, otherwise, storage is, you're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars more per acre, and the farmers just cannot afford to do that. It's economics. If you are willing to give us $2, $3, $4, $500 million, like $200 million like Washington did, maybe we do something about it.
Well, perhaps. I mean, this is my non-scientific, so I'm very limited in this respect, but I've just got to think there's major fish repercussions of doing it in the summer versus when you would, if you did in the winter, and perhaps that is, we've certainly done it through BPA, is spent a lot of money to try to get a twofer rather than a one-fer.
Senator, I'll speak on the impacts of the fish impacts in the summer in my testimony.
Which I wish I could stay for. I have another committee that's meeting right now. Well,
it's written testimony.
I've been reading it.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Anderson, why don't we go with you, and why don't you start with that, so that when all our committees got changed time-wise today, as you know, and so we're all kind of scrambling. But if you'd introduce yourself, maybe start with the fish impact issue, so that when Senator Ecker doesn't go, at least he's heard orally.
Right.
What you
My name is Jim Anderson, and I'm a research professor at the University of Washington School of Fisheries. I've been studying this this issue for 20 years. In 1987, there was a meeting I attended where we talked about the impacts of flow on survival. Back then, it was believed that flow had a great impact on survival. After 20 years of research and thousands of tags being placed in fish, we have found no significant impact of flow on survival. What we found is temperature is a major determinant of survival, not flow. Temperature and flow have a tendency to be correlated. In low flow years, there's some higher temperature, and that is the main driver of the what was appeared to be a flow survival factor. Now, the thing about the most important thing we're concerned with, as I understand it, is the summer runs, the fall chinookas are moving down through the system. We don't have as much data on that. And what they've been able to determine from the limited amounts of data is there is no relationship between flow and survival. And a good way to illustrate this is in 2001, it was the lowest flow year, there was 100 KCFS coming down through the river, about 60% survival through the John Day Reservoir in that year. 2002 was a high flow year, about twice as much water went down the river in July and August, about 60% survival during that period. The temperatures were the same during those particular periods. So if flow does not affect fish, and that's what the data shows, what is the impact, and why does not flow affect fish? Because you would think that the faster they go, the less exposure they would have to the predators. I have one of my inclusions here is a mathematical model based on data which explains why flow and travel time are not important factors. And it's really quite intuitive. The predators are local. They sit there, wait for the smolts to come by. The smolts are migrating through the system. They're running a gauntlet. In a gauntlet, you have one chance to get the smolt that's coming by. If it passes you, that's it. You have to wait for the next one. From the smolt's point of view, then, it's not how fast you go through the gauntlet. It's how long the gauntlet is. That means that survival is a function of distance, not of flow. That's the essential feature of why there's no flow-survival relationship. Now, temperature works into this, too, because these predators, northern pike minnow, are hungrier. They eat more when the temperature is higher. So there's always the same number of predators there, but when it's 10 degrees centigrade, they're not hungry. They don't eat very many fish. When it turns up and it's 20 degrees centigrade, they will eat seven times as many fish as they would otherwise. When we thought there was a flow-survival relationship, that was based on seven data points, seven different years where we had some very, very primitive and imprecise techniques to describe the impacts of flow on survival. Now we have thousands and thousands and thousands of fish that are tagged with pit tags. We have more information on how this system works than any other fishery scientists have in the world, and we just simply haven't found a flow-survival relationship. That's the story.
Senator Decker.
Thanks. Just one quick. Could we fill this room, or maybe better put is and Dr. Anderson, I wish I could go through the whole. Is your position well represented in fishery science, or could we fill this room with other fishery scientists that might argue with that position?
That information I'm basing it on is in the COMPASS model, which is a model which was based on earlier models we developed. It was developed by NOAA with assistance of other agencies, including state and tribal agencies. It was reviewed by the Independent Scientific Advisory Board all through its development, and these are results of that model.
So it is.
It's the best available research.
It is in the mainstream of fishery science is that flow does not, and no expertise in sitting here, but that is the mainstream position of fishery science is that flow does not impact.
And there is a report by the ISAB, Reservoir Operations Flow Survival Symposium, which concludes some of that, plus the work that comes out of the COMPASS model, and there's a lot of support for that. It's an old idea that flow was important, and that was important to try to resolve that. And we have not found any flow-survival relationship. There's a tiny, tiny one for steelhead, and the amount of water that they're proposing to withdraw would change the survival of steelhead through the entire system from an average of 28% to 27.8%. Two hundredths or 0.2% change, which is an insignificant change. And in particular, most of the fish are barged through the system, so they're not experiencing the flow through the John Day Reservoir.
I have a question.
Any other questions, Senator?
Well, and perhaps if I called around, and again, I'm just banking on this lack of expertise sitting right here, but if I called around to fishery scientists, they would all say, or many, I know you can't get unanimity on these kind of questions, but many, many would say, Dr. Anderson hit it on the head. Flow, other than that small steelhead, which probably bears exploration, flow does not impact fish survival.
I'm just using the information in the NOAA's model, that this is a conclusion from that work, and I've been part of that work for 20 years. And this, I'm not wearing a button because I'm not taking sides here. I'm taking a side to figure out what the science is saying, and this is what 20 years of research. This is the conclusion we come to,
Thank
that
you.
I've come to with this, and that's what the model says.
Thank you.
Senator Starr.
Well, it seems to me, based on that, based on what you did say, that what does affect smolts is temperature, that if you have low flows, the temperature would rise. But there's no correlation between that? That isn't, if you have less water in the river, it seems to me in the middle of summer that...
I have one graph in there which I, you know, I didn't explain this in a lot of detail, but basically in the summer the temperature is being controlled by exchange with the atmosphere, the atmospheric exchange of heat, and the temperature is uniform throughout the river from McNary Dam to Bonneville Dam. Temperatures go up and down on a daily basis, so it's the heat exchange which is producing the changes in temperature. Now, something I didn't discuss, and I didn't realize because I hadn't read the, I didn't realize the significance, but groundwater recharge, which brings water back into the system, and particularly at lower levels, can be cooler than the surface water. And this could be refugium for fish, which would be, I think, significant. And if anything, I would think that people should look at how temperature and water uses throughout the system are affecting fish. And we're not doing that right now because we've been so focused, and in my words, I would say hung up on this flow survival issue when we should be getting to and focusing more on what are the underlying ecological factors affecting these fish.
And I'd like to follow up on that particular point.
Okay,
yeah. In my area, we have a little creek called Fairview Creek, and we had a lot of development, and we cut down trees and everything. So we developed the Fairview Creek Watershed District, started having setbacks and planted trees, and by gum, we now have fish coming up that because the water temperature, we have the trees shading the water, we develop the environment for fish to come back, and they're back.
Yeah.
Center stuff.
Not many, but they're back.
If I may mention, on the temperature, I've studied this for over 5 years. If you have a creek which is 10 foot wide, 20 feet wide, the shading does have an impact. Columbia River is
that's
a mile wide.
Yeah. That's
no
very
tree
different.
Plantation would ever happen.
You would need a very big tree.
Center star.
So just to follow up and continue this conversation about the temperature, you're saying that that the reduction in flow is not during the summer months, and or the reduction in flow based on the amount of water you're going to take off will have an insignificant amount to do with temperature of the water, especially when coupled with the groundwater recharging of the river. That would be my
first order guess. An example to that, in 2001 when we had 100 kcfs, in 2002 when you had almost twice as much, the August temperatures were the same, or the July temperatures were the same. There's models that have detailed models that the Corps has developed and EPA to look at the temperature exchange, the temperature patterns, and I do not believe that they've applied those models to the lower river. And it's a good study, but the data that you have is, I think I can pretty much guess what the final conclusion would be to those papers, so that it's an atmospheric exchange. And in fact, I could give you a number of papers which show that for other regions.
I thank you very much for your testimony and appreciate you being here today.
Thank you very much. It's like Senator Deckard, I don't have expertise in the biological aspects of water, but having been a fisherman for my whole life, very active, particularly for an anadromous fish, it is very clear from a fishing standpoint that, you know, temperature is the issue. It's when they bite also. And trying to figure out when that is, but also, and you see it in the large body waters, you know, like the Deschutes, and then a huge body water like the Columbia, you know, fish gravitate to those levels of where that temperature is, and water's cooler down below,
I think as Senator Montes Anderson and well, Senator Starr alluded to, if you just have a little trickle in the backyard, then it's affected. The temperature can be affected by shading and everything else. But it's a temperature thing. And then the question is, what does create the temperature? And I do think, just anecdotally, I think it makes common sense to think that in a big body like the Columbia, it's going to be a lot of other reasons besides necessarily just the flow. In fact, some of the predators that you're talking about, we need to get rid of a lot of the seals out there that that have a big, major effect on predation of the adults that are coming back to spawn. You've talked about the pike, and I love fishing for walleye out there, but a lot of those fish survive well in the water of the Columbia now because we've dammed them and we've made stiller waters where in the old days they were not native to that area. So we've created other things that impact fish besides all that.
You sound like an ecologist.
Yeah, well. It's just a fisher person, So, we have changed a lot of dynamics in the river. Now, the question is, and I do appreciate your presentation today, is, what to do. It's the old line, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, and there's a lot of really serious issues regarding what we do about, our use of our water resources and the impact for things that we also care very much about, fish, which I care a heck of a lot about, as our salmon population. So I do believe, as the Native Americans do, that, it is an indicator species of how the rest of us are doing. But sometimes we can get carried away in terms of making assumptions that aren't necessarily based in science. And I appreciate you coming, Fred, appreciate your work. I think this was just important for the committee. I don't know what's going to happen, except that I do know something is moving because of the rules in the House, and I wanted our committee to have at least a primer on this issue, not to get into detail, if in fact the situation evolves where we may have an opportunity to actually hear the pro and cons of it. So thank you very, very much, and I appreciate the fact that the committee was so attentive and under a very difficult time. With that, we are adjourned.